This is Lapham's Quarterly, the podcast.
Hi, welcome to the Lapham's Quarterly podcast. I'm Aiden Flax Clark. For anyone listening who didn't hear the previous show, today's episode is actually the second of two parts about the current state of the oceans. And I swear that was not intended as a terrible pun, but I apologize for saying it anyway. With our sea issue about to go off the stands, and having spent so much time in the magazine and the podcast looking into the history of our oceans, I thought the best way to give this subject a proper send-off was to turn to the present and check in with what's happening today. Unfortunately, for those of you who did listen to the first part, you know that the news isn't so great. On the last episode, we talked about rising sea levels, struggling coral reefs, global overfishing, and the freak explosion of jellyfish populations around the planet. So that was fun. We heard from marine biologists Callum Roberts, Jeremy Jackson, and Lisa Ann Gershwin, as well as writer and regular LQ contributor Simon Winchester. Well, today, some of those people are back, and they'll join in with a few new voices to talk mostly about pollution. You can't really list the enemies of the sea without talking about it. Real quick, though, before we get to that, don't forget that you can always visit us on our website, laphamsquarterly.org, where you can subscribe to the magazine, pick up back issues you've missed, and even give us a donation if you're feeling extra generous. You can also find links to all of our social medias there. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and you can follow us on all of them. And if you're liking the podcast, don't forget to leave us some feedback in the comments section of the iTunes store. All right, quick plugs done. Let's get to the show. As in the previous episode, we'll give the opening argument to Jeremy Jackson. Jeremy's a marine biologist and a paleobiologist, which means that he studies the long-term impacts that humanity's had on the seas. While we were working on our sea issue, I came across a lecture that he gave earlier this year at the U.S. Naval War College. It's called Ocean Apocalypse, and the details he gave in it about the real trouble our oceans are facing are largely what spurred me to put together this episode. By the way, I forgot to mention in the previous episode that the lecture is available in its entirety on YouTube, and it's definitely worth watching. We've got a link to it on our website. Here's Jeremy from that lecture about pollution in the seas.
Think where you were born, think where you grew up. Try to imagine what the land would be like if all or most of the garbage and the sewage and the toxic waste that was produced where you grew up was not thrown in the ocean, but was piled up in the land next to where you lived. I mean, New York City alone sends barges per day of human sewage out to the deadest dead zone in the global ocean. The ocean is the sewer of humanity, and it has been forever.
The ocean is downhill from everywhere, so no matter where you drop a plastic wrapper, it ends up in the ocean. It's a downhill run. As soon as the wind blows and the rain falls, things start heading towards the sea.
That second voice you heard belongs to a sailor and scientist named Captain Charles Moore, who we're going to hear from today. Captain Moore has had a lot of experience with trash in the ocean, particularly with a phenomenon known as the garbage patch. You may have heard about these things. I mean, though there's all kinds of pollution at sea worth discussing, and we're going to talk about a fair amount of it, the thought of the garbage patch is easily the most dramatic. Giant rings of trash swirling in a plasticky vortex around various parts of our oceans. And roughly, that's what they are. By ways of winds and currents, a great bulk of humanity's refuse in the water ends up circling together in a sort of fixed pattern, kept there by these winds and currents and forming these things that we call garbage patches. I got a good simple description of how that works from a friend and colleague of Captain Moore's whose name is Curtis Ebbesmeyer. Ebbesmeyer is a specialist in a field with the absolutely tremendous name of flotsometrics, which is basically the study of how ocean debris flows around the world and where something dropped at one point in the water will eventually end up. So as you might imagine, Ebbesmeyer's had some pretty good experience with these garbage patches.
To me, it's pretty simple. I don't know where you live exactly, but in my house here, it's a pretty old house, and we have dust bunnies. And they get big enough, you just pick them up and put them in the trash. Well, the ocean is pretty much like our house. It has, but the dust bunnies are planetary in size, And they are basically where trash collects, and they collect beneath the high-pressure cells that sailors like to avoid because they don't have any wind inside. So what you have is you have about 8 of them on the planet, and they circle around, and they collect trash. And if you total the whole area, it's about the size of the United States.
Callum Roberts, the marine biologist and author of The Ocean of Life, who you heard from in the last episode of the podcast, explained to me the mechanics of how a garbage patch comes into existence.
Well, the garbage tends to accumulate in these areas of rotating currents, and those rotating currents lie in the middle of the oceans. So the North Pacific has two, and the Indian Ocean has one great rotational patch. The Atlantic has another couple. So inside these rotating currents, in a way, the water piles up there because of the way the currents move, and then it sinks down in the middle like water going down a plug hole, and that concentrates all the floating stuff at the surface, and it holds it there.
Those areas of rotating currents are known as gyres, and inside one gyre in the North Pacific is the largest garbage patch in the world, which Curtis Ebesmeyer has dubbed the Great North Pacific Garbage Patch. Somewhere between the west coast of the continental U.S. and Hawaii, it's a soupy mess of plastic, debris, slime, fishing nets, and all kinds of other human leftovers. And it's somewhere between the size of 1 to 3 Texases, and the gyre it exists inside of is roughly as big as Africa. Estimating the garbage patch's size more precisely is difficult, as Charles Moore explained to me when he was describing the specific currents that create the gyre, which is home to the Great North Pacific Garbage Patch.
It's created by the descent of air that has been warmed at the equator. As it moves toward the pole, the atmosphere is warmest at the equator, and hot air rises. So a cooler air rushing in pushes that air north and south. And as the air moving to the north cools, it descends and rotates in a clockwise direction. That creates currents that bounce off the continents, bounce off California, create the California current, then they get caught in the equatorial current moving across the Pacific to Asia, then they get caught in the Kuroshio current, which is like the Gulf Stream of Asia. It moves up the coast of Japan. And then the fourth stage is the westerly wind drift, which begins as the lows come off of Siberia and pushes the water from the west to the east. So you have this circular clockwise movement, 4 separate current systems that join together to create a circular current with a period of rotation of 6 years, as calculated by Dr. Ebesmeyer. So that outer rim is fairly stable, but these garbage patches spin off on the inside. And Dr. Ebesmeyer calculates that the period of rotation of this inner garbage patch area is 10 months, and it's less stable. It doesn't always form in the same way. These are sub-eddies inside of this larger stable system, sort of sub-spirals on this larger stable spiral, and they're not as fixed and as predictable as the outer rim of it.
All that said, it's definitely huge. I mean, let's split the difference and say it's double the size of Texas. 2 Texases worth of trash anywhere is a horrifying thought. Because the patch being in this area of water where sailors don't like to sail, and because of its mercurial nature, scientists were able to predict its existence before they actually saw it. In 1988, researchers at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, were certain of a swirling trash vortex in the North Pacific, but they didn't lay eyes on it. But that changed in 1997, when Captain Moore happened to be sailing home to Long Beach, California, after he had finished a race that took him from Los Angeles to Hawaii. At the time, Captain Moore wasn't aware of the garbage patch or NOAA's predictions, so he wasn't on the hunt for it or anything like that. He wasn't even on any kind of scientific voyage. But his route did happen to bring him right up against the high-pressure area of the Pacific where the patch was thought to lurk.
We ended up going through it because we had auxiliary diesel engines, and we thought we could just go up to the latitude of Los Angeles and then cut across. And so we did have a very long transit through this high-pressure zone.
And what he found there was staggering. In an article called Trashed, which he wrote a few years after the voyage, and incidentally, which you can find in the Voices in Time in our C issue, Moore says, "I was confronted, as far as the eye could see, with the sight of plastic. It seemed unbelievable, but I never found a clear spot. In the week it took to cross the subtropical high, no matter what time of day I looked, plastic debris was floating everywhere,
bottles, bottle caps, wrappers, fragments. And he realized that what he was seeing wasn't just random bits of trash, but that it was connected to the currents in the ocean.
And I made an association between the high and the trash that turned out other scientists had already made that association, but it was a discovery to me.
Moore shared his findings with a few important people, and in his book, Plastic Ocean, he says that that pretty much changed the course of his life. One of them was a man he read about in the Los Angeles Times, who was known for his specialization in patterns of marine debris floating at sea, flotsometrics, our friend Dr. Ebesmeyer. Ebesmeyer apparently knew about NOAA's predictions of the garbage patch, and he was excited to hear about it from Moore, and he encouraged him to keep pursuing to find out exactly what was going on out there. Moore says that he had made an estimate of how much trash might be in the patch, guessing that there could easily be 3 million tons, the equivalent of a year's dump at Los Angeles' largest landfill. I resolved, he wrote, to return someday to test my alarming estimate. And to help him with that, he contacted some friends at an institution called the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project.
Got them to design a sampling plan to go out and sample this high, that area of light winds that I found all this trash in, and we quantified it, and that's when we realized there was more plastic out there than plankton, and that's what blew the lid off the whole issue.
I think he's made something like 10 or maybe a dozen expeditions out there, and he tows a very fine net, mesh net, and he actually counts the particles, which is incredible. He's the person that has sampled the great garbage patch by far the most.
And what Moore's discovered out there, he describes in Trashed as a rich broth of minute sea creatures mixed with hundreds of colored plastic fragments, a plastic plankton soup. And I mean, he saw plenty of crazy trash out there too. Here's a short list of some things that floated past. A drum of hazardous chemicals, an inflated volleyball half covered in gooseneck barnacles, a plastic coat hanger with a swivel hook, a cathode ray tube for a 19-inch TV, an inflated truck tire mounted on a steel rim, a gallon-sized bleach bottle that was so brittle it crumbled in our hands, and a menacing medusa of tangled net lines and hawsers that we hung from the A-frame of our catamaran. But the bulk of the garbage patch consists of those little plastic bits, the soup. Unlike many discarded materials, Moore writes, most plastics in common use do not biodegrade. Instead, they photodegrade, a process whereby sunlight breaks them into progressively smaller pieces, all of which are still plastic polymers. So if most of the trash is breaking down into these smaller and smaller pieces, what does the garbage patch actually look like? Is it some kind of island of trash? I asked Captain Moore to describe it to me and what he saw on his first voyage.
It wasn't an aha moment where I saw a big island of trash. It was day after day just not being able to come on deck without seeing some bit of something floating by and trying to guess how much must be out there. It's just a piece here and a piece there. It's not... They're not touching, you know. It's not a mat of stuff.
Very often the material that's out in the garbage patch is in long lines, slick lines. So the ocean gathers things into lines where one current meets the other. Very often one current will dive down below the other. And the flotsam floats, so it can't dive with the current. So it stacks up along the line of the intersection of the two currents. And some... There was one line across the South Pacific that went hundreds of miles, and it was only about, I don't know, 50 feet wide, but it probably went 500 miles across the South Pacific Ocean.
According to Donovan Hone, who was led into the Pacific by his book Moby Duck, which is about a shipment of bath toys that was lost in transit between China and the U.S., the garbage patch isn't something that you can really see. There's no monstrous island of refuse that you suddenly come upon out in the middle of the ocean.
When I first pictured it, I pictured something I think that was very much in a kind of a fabulous vein of like a floating junkyard. I remember kind of imagining, oh, I want to go there. And if you dropped overboard in a small boat, in a dinghy or a canoe, you'd be paddling through this thicket of debris. In fact, you go out there and it's spread out over so many millions of square miles of ocean that it's not so visible to the naked eye.
It's not that you have a problem finding trash. It's that if you start to look for heavy concentrations, you know, much heavier than the average, that's when you start to have difficulty.
Because the plastic degrades, and it doesn't biodegrade, but because it disintegrates, It's blowing through the water column like dust through air, and you might come across a thicket of stuff tangled in seaweed or in an old ghost net. And you'll come across, perhaps because of the weird meanders of the currents, there might be a cluster of objects that you'll run into. But most of what's out there, you can't see with the naked eye.
At first, that might sound like it's actually better than an island of trash. Obviously, seeing a drum of toxic chemicals or a discarded yacht bob past you in the ocean is a sight that you're not going to forget. On the other hand, a drum of toxic waste is way easier to clean up than the dust in the air that Donovan described. We actually couldn't rid the ocean of all the trash that's out there, even if we wanted to. I mean, how do you clean up a million microscopic, essentially invisible plastic fragments that have insinuated their way into the water? And if we can't clean it up, what becomes of all that plastic out there?
These plastic molecules have molecular weights of hundreds of thousands to millions. They're basically undigestible to all creatures on the Earth. So it never goes away. It just gets smaller and smaller down to perhaps, nobody really quite knows, but down to maybe 10 or 100 molecules. You can't see it, but those molecules are getting into a complete food web, including ourselves. So I always tell people, whenever you buy something from the ocean, you're buying some plastic. It's in everything.
So there you have it. An insidious, largely invisible maelstrom of garbage, insinuating its way into the water, the sea life, and, when we eat that sea life, back into us. And invisible or not, one thing that's for sure about plastic trash, both in these garbage patches and the waters beyond them, is that there's more and more of it. And at the moment, that seems only bound to get worse. Callum Roberts notes in The Ocean of Life that in the first 10 years of this millennium, there was more plastic produced than had ever been produced previously since the invention of plastic. I cited that fact to Captain Moore.
It's incredible to think about that, but the consequence of that is that in the first 10 years of this millennium, we doubled the pollution by plastic of the planet. I estimated up through 2006, I estimated 100 million tons were out there. We're rapidly approaching 200 million tons now.
It is just a manifestation of this upward racing curve of increase in consumption and energy use by people. So here we have the world in which it's increasingly affluent. There's an increasing middle class. We're all surrounded by convenience.
The developing world is proliferating this material with no awareness of its longevity. The Indonesian population, enormous population, has got rivers clogged with it. If you've seen the movie Trashed with Jeremy Irons, you see horrific pictures from countries where landfilling is still going on right at the riverside and being dumped into the ocean. And that happens in China. I've seen an island off of Hong Kong where the Chinese are landfilling right onto the beach, and that the styrofoam balls that have degraded from the cups were like powdered snow up to your waist, you know, right on the beach there. Then when the tide's high and the wind's blowing, it takes it out to sea. You know, a friend of mine went to the jungles of Belize for a vacation, and the people in the jungle cut him a coconut and opened it up, and instead of letting him drink the coconut water out of the coconut, they poured it into a plastic cup, you know, in the middle of the jungle.
But don't get the impression that Captain Moore is trying to lay all of the blame at the feet of developing countries. The U.S., of course, is hardly innocent. Captain Moore's own marine research institution, which is called Algalita, notes that we produce 25 million tons of plastic every year here in the U.S. And the EPA, which actually puts that number at closer to 32 million tons, says that only 8% of that plastic gets recycled.
And it's terribly ironic that things that are used for instant disposal are made out of a substance that is so hard to destroy. So here we have a bag that is used once for a few minutes to carry the shopping to the car, for example, which is made of a substance that will be around for hundreds or thousands of years to come. And it has the potential to cause increasing mischief as that substance fragments gradually into smaller and smaller pieces. And the plastic particles, they contain a lot of toxic chemicals, flame retardants, plasticizers, etc. But they also attract a lot of toxic chemicals.
The plastics act like a sponge for these chemicals. The PCBs, the legacy, what we call the legacy pollutants, the persistent organic pollutants like PCBs and DDT and their metabolites, those compounds that don't really go away, they're persistent, and they are sponged up by especially polypropylene and polyethylene plastics, which are the major consumer plastics that we find in the ocean.
And then they get passed into the food web. And guess who's right at the top of the food chain? If you enjoy tuna, you're eating something which was the king of predators in the sea, and now it's being ingested by the king of predators on land. And that's where the toxins end up, inside you.
But as the plastic makes its way into our bodies, it makes other stops in the food chain and back onto the land along the way for all kinds of other mishigas. Donovan Hone told me, for instance, about visiting beaches in the Pacific during his trip out to the garbage patch and the accumulation of trash he witnessed along the shores.
You can see it. I mean, here we are in some of in the northwestern Hawaiian archipelago, some of the most remote islands on the planet, uninhabited, where you have to get government permission to visit them, where you have to freeze your clothes so you don't bring invasive species. Even there, there'll be these beaches strewn with debris.
Albatrosses, which nest on incredibly remote specks of land in the middle of the ocean, far from any human habitation, they are picking up all this plastic and feeding their chicks on it, to the tune of about 70 items of plastic per feeding expedition. And chicks are dying on those beaches that, whose bodies are packed with more than 500 pieces of plastic. So literally, they're dying on a diet of junk food.
And sea turtles eat plastic bags. The container industry gets after me and they say, "Hey, Kurt, we don't lose that many containers." And I said, "Well, 2 to 10,000 is a lot." And, "Oh, no, we ship 200 million a year. That's a pretty low accident rate." And I say, "Well, yeah, statistics are one thing, but the death of a sea turtle is something else." And I said, "Do you realize that there's just 2 containers? Each container can hold about 10 million plastic shopping bags?" And they say, "Well, so what?" "Well, it only takes 1 shopping bag to choke a sea turtle, and 10 call it 5 million shopping bags is more than probably the total sea turtle population in the North Pacific. So 1 container has enough plastic shopping bags in it to kill off all the sea turtles in the North Pacific." And so it's not so much in numbers. You have to look at the effects of just a single amount of plastic on a single population.
You know, inevitably, if you're transporting more and more goods around the world, and the sea is a stormy and hostile environment, you're going to lose stuff at sea. But the bigger source of input to the oceans is not from ships, and deliberate dumping from ships is illegal, but it's from the coast. So if you live in a coastal town and you see pieces of plastic blowing around, a lot of that ends up blowing into the sea. If you live by a river, as I do, you see pieces of plastic junk floating past constantly, especially when the river is in flood. And so all of that stuff is pushed out to sea. Those plastic bottles and bags are launched on voyages that may be thousands of years long. They may go tens of thousands of kilometers during that time. And it's really sobering to think what a mad waste that is. And how, you know, generations 200-300 years from now will be dealing with the refuse that we have released into the sea.
Pollution flowing out of rivers isn't just dumping our plastic into the ocean, and it's not just coastal areas that are problematic as sources for refuse. Like Captain Moore said, the ocean is downhill from everything. So if you start dumping harmful substances into, say, the Mississippi River in, say, Iowa, eventually you're going to find yourself with a problem in Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening in this country. Farms upriver on the Mississippi, and largely in the Midwest, growing mostly corn, use staggering amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus-based fertilizers that run off into the Mississippi River. And the runoff of those nutrients in the fertilizer, the nitrogen and the phosphorus, eventually makes its way down to the Gulf and helps sustain and enlarge a seasonal aquatic occurrence called hypoxia, which is better known by its colloquial zombie movie-like name, Dead Zone. A dead zone is a naturally occurring incidence in the water, but in the Gulf, the excessive use of fertilizer is making things worse. In fact, the Gulf dead zone is the second largest in the world. To learn more about it and about hypoxia more generally, I spoke to Nancy Rabelais, a marine ecologist who's been working in the Gulf since the 1980s. She's the executive director of LUMCON, the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. And in her years studying hypoxia, lecturing about it, and testifying before Congress about it, she's come to know more about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico than anyone else. Nancy spoke to me over Skype from LUMCON's headquarters in Chauvin, Louisiana. For starters, she explained to me what hypoxia really is.
Hypoxia means oxygen below the level that can support the marine resources that we're familiar with, like shrimp and crabs and fish and starfishes and things like that.
And then she explained how hypoxia occurs.
It's usually a combination of the physics and the biology. The physics is a result of warming of surface waters over cooler bottom waters, and that creates a density difference. The weight of the water on the top is less than the weight of the water on the bottom. And in many coastal areas, it's also related to the influx of fresh water into saltier coastal oceans. And the salt water is less dense than the saltier bottom water, so you get a layered system. When you have a layered system, the oxygen from the surface can't make it to the bottom. The biological part of this is that the nutrients stimulate the growth of the algae, the microscopic plants, and not all of them are eaten. They sink to the bottom, and the bacteria that decompose them use up oxygen. And when that layered system exists, oxygen can't get from the surface to the bottom as quickly as the bacteria can consume the oxygen from the organic matter on the bottom. And there ends up being an imbalance or a lack of oxygen at the seabed and in the lower water column.
But as catchy as dead zone is as a name, it's not exactly accurate.
It's not completely dead. There are plenty of things that can live in the upper water column. And there are a few things that remain alive in the sediments, and there's a whole different microbial community which thrives in low oxygen conditions.
Or, as Jeremy Jackson put it more bluntly,
dead zones are a virtual zoo of microbes and jellyfish.
And so, while it's true that low oxygen water happens without human intervention, the level it's at in places like the Gulf of Mexico is impossible without the touch of a human hand. Nancy explained to me. By the way, during our interview, we lost the Skype connection, so for the rest of the time, you'll hear Nancy on the phone.
The physical conditions, the fresher water and the warmer water on top and the colder, saltier water in the bottom is necessary for the low oxygen to occur, but it didn't occur historically, and human activities in the watershed have created basically the areas of low oxygen. Human beings have intensified agriculture and the use of fertilizers in the middle of the U.S. And because of that, more nutrients are applied and more nutrients are getting into the Mississippi River, particularly the nitrogen, but also the phosphorus. So it's basically too much of a good thing.
And that good thing, of course, that we're having too much of is corn. And corn is complicated. The crop, and therefore the fertilizer problem, grows hundreds of miles away from the Gulf itself, in a different region of the country, in states with different priorities, different elected officials, different issues. And then there's all of the politics around ethanol, not to mention our national love-hate relationship with high-fructose corn syrup. And those things are important because, as Jeremy Jackson points out,
if you ask the question, what's all that corn used for? 95, 99% of it is used for three things. It's used for ethanol, it's used for high fructose corn syrup, and it's used for hog food. And almost all of the hogs raised in Iowa go to Russia and China.
According to a chart from the USDA's Economic Research Service, in the 2012-2013 season, of the roughly 11 billion bushels of corn grown in this country, around 10 million of them went to, quote, feed and residual use and, quote, alcohol for fuel use. And it went pretty evenly between those two. And the rest went to, quote, other food, seed, and industrial uses. So whatever corn is making its way to us as grilled on the cob or chopped up in a salad isn't much. But the amount of corn we've grown in this country has increased dramatically in the last few decades. In 1980, we grew about 5 billion bushels. The forecast for the 2013-2014 season, according to the USDA, is about 13.8 billion bushels, a record high. And the USDA says more and more of that corn is being grown on large farms, which they classify as being over 500 acres, while the number of smaller farms in this country is steadily diminishing. But it's no surprise that corn production has gone up so much. You know, in this country, we've inflated demand for it in recent years by offering subsidies for growing feed corn and by mandating ever more ethanol get into our fuel supply. And between arguments about ethanol's energy efficiency, how difficult transporting it over pipelines has proved to be, and the fact that cars burning it get lower gas mileage, at the very least, you can definitely say that the fuel is not the miracle anti-gasoline it was once thought to be. And of course, think about what all this corn is doing to the Gulf of Mexico. And on that account, I asked Nancy if she'd ever had a chance to talk to people at fertilizer companies about any of these issues.
Yes, I have. They do things that are most cost-effective to them, which in the long run, most of the people who study sustainable agriculture do not think that that will be able to perpetuate itself into the future. So there are others who are looking at different types of crops, different types of fertilizer application, more perennials, more sustainable agriculture, and they would like to see that sort of agriculture replace the monoculture of corn and sometimes the alternation with soybeans in much of the Midwest.
Are there any signs that that's actually happening?
On a small scale, it's happening, but not at the scale it needs to happen to make a difference in the nutrient runoff into the rivers.
I mean, what is the scale that would be required for such a thing?
Well, there'd have to be a scaling back of over application of fertilizers. There'd have to be some dealing with the tile drains that run the water off the cornfields and intercepting some of those nutrients before they got to the streams and the Mississippi River. There'd need to be some effort to create artificial wetlands that have been destroyed as agriculture has taken over the middle of the country. There can be some reestablishment of the drainage basin so that there's overland flow and flood conditions so that the wetlands that used to parallel and buffer the Mississippi River can go back and take some of those natural nitrogen removal processes over. There's possible improvement in wastewater treatment. Some of the nutrients that get into the Gulf come from atmospheric deposition related to coal and gas-powered electrical plants and also automobiles. So anything we can do to decrease our carbon footprint is definitely going to help. But most of the nutrients that come from the basin that affect both their water quality and that in the Gulf of Mexico is from agricultural activities.
And I asked Nancy if there had been any success stories with any farmers.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people now who are very concerned about sustainable agriculture and who are trying to do the right thing. But these are usually the smaller farms and the farmers that control that land, not the big agribusiness.
And I also asked Nancy if she'd had any dealings with any politicians on any of these questions and how that had gone.
Well, I have, and our research has changed policies at the federal level with the formation of the Hypoxia and Gulf of Mexico Nutrient Task Force that has developed action plans to try to reduce the nutrients. Their plans just have not been effective.
I mean, have any of those action plans gone into effect and worked, or are they just right now in the state of being plans?
My personal opinion is that they're paper products only.
It's generally much easier to prevent and control pollution when it comes from a discrete, discernible source, what's called a point source, such as offshore drilling or a pipe at a factory or a sewage treatment plant. Non-point source pollution from agriculture, on the other hand, is more difficult to identify and prevent because it comes from many diffuse sources.
That voice belongs to Alan Seelan. Alan is currently a non-resident senior fellow for international environmental policy at Scripps. But before that, he was a longtime employee of the EPA, serving as deputy assistant administrator of international activities between 1995 and 2001. He's worked on a number of international maritime agreements, including in the 1970s on the Law of the Sea Convention and in the late 90s on the London Ocean Dumping Convention, but his work at the EPA has also led him to deal with domestic issues too, like the questions of industrial agriculture. He spoke to me over Skype from his home in Washington, D.C.
Large, powerful industries often prefer to keep their own environmental houses in order
rather than have government oversee and regulate their activities. That's fine in theory. No one likes unnecessary regulation or intrusion into their lives. Our economic and political cultures certainly tilt toward finding voluntary, collaborative solutions to improve environmental performance. There are many ways that government, industry, and others do this through such things as research, environmental education, and encouraging sustainable agricultural practices. However, these kinds of things in themselves are frequently not enough. And when a particular industry fails over an extended period to prevent massive influxes of nutrient pollution into our streams, rivers, lakes, and coastal areas, I think it's time to take a serious look at how we as a society go about protecting human health and the environment. What this means is that we may, in fact, need more active government involvement at the federal, state, and local level.
Whether or not government intervention will provide the answer in the Gulf, it's worth remembering that the dead zone there is, while the largest we have in this country, not the only one. We heard on the last episode about the Chesapeake Bay, which has a real dead zone problem, as does Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest. And the number of dead zones around the planet is increasing too. It's been calculated by marine biologists that that number has doubled each decade since the 1960s.
In developed countries, in U.S., in North America, and in Europe, that trend was seen in the 60s to the 80s and hasn't really been reversed except in one area. And developing countries are now taking the same path and using more fertilizers and having big agribusiness. So they are now, they're about 20 years behind, but they're now seeing the same increase in nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. And the globe is seeing more areas of low oxygen or dead zones in the coastal ocean.
So I asked Nancy to tell me about some of the trouble spots around the world, and they're everywhere, from the Americas to China.
There's a large area of low oxygen off the Zhangjiang River, which is the Yangtze River. There are probably areas off of Hong Kong. The Baltic Sea has a lot of low oxygen. It's sort of a natural low oxygen area, but it's definitely gotten worse over the years. Many of the coastal regions bordering Europe into the North Sea are having low oxygen problems. The northern Adriatic off of the Po River is having problems. A lot of the areas off of the east coast of South America now are having problems they didn't have in the past.
Brazil, the economic miracle of South America, will be solid dead zones at the rate they're going.
The numbers of dead zones have been exploding all over the world just in the last few decades.
You'll probably recognize that voice as belonging to Lisa Ann Gershwin, who we heard from on the last episode telling us about the explosions of jellyfish populations in damaged marine environments, which she wrote about in her book Stung.
The water column over the dead zones is dominated by algae and jellyfish. And, you know, so we've got these huge, huge areas. Like there's this one huge dead zone off the coast of Namibia in Africa, and it's dominated by two species of jellyfish. And not much else lives there. Not much else. There's hundreds of dead zones all over the world, you know, forming this kind of dotted line that pretty much outlines the continents of the world.
And when the water gets dominated by algae, that can cause big problems for us.
In places like Florida, for example, we see an increasing frequency of harmful algal blooms, these red tides, which when the ocean churns the sea into an aerosol and blows over the coast, people end up getting breathing problems from inhaling the toxic organisms there. In other parts of the world, for example, the Yellow Sea in China, there are these massive green tides that are emerging where whole beaches and resorts and seafronts are buried under meters of thick green seaweed, which ultimately has come from the over-enrichment of the coastal waters by nutrients. And then, you know, you can no longer use that coast to enjoy a day out. That is a place that's become toxic. We see the same sort of thing in France and in Puget Sound, for example, where these kind of massive seaweed growth is causing problems for coastal residents. These are not isolated instances. These are part of a growing trend of the sea becoming less able to sustain life as we know it. The oceans not only support a huge amount of life, but they are life-sustaining. The oceans occupy more than 95% of the volume of living space on the planet, and therefore they have an overwhelming influence on the processes that keep our planet habitable and comfortable for us. And the problem for us is that we've tended to just take them for granted. We assume that things are carrying on perfectly well in the sea. And so it's come as a surprise to a lot of people to find that the oceans are actually not only affected by human activity, given their vastness, but that effect is sufficiently large that it's eroding things like quality of life and ability of the ocean to sustain a healthy environment for people.
I think most people, when they think of the damage we've done to the ecosystems, I think they think of it as kind of like a moral issue. You know, they think, oh, well, when I'm feeling virtuous, I remember to recycle, or, you know, I'll join Greenpeace and I'll contribute, you know, some amount of money per year, and that makes me feel good. And I think most people see conservation as a moral choice, but I don't think they see it in terms of that what we do to nature we are actually doing to ourselves.
I think we all care about these things. It's connecting the dots. It's making the connection between what goes on when we open a bottle of wine and kiss our kids or grandchildren or whatever we do, and the cold, dark world outside.
There's a sort of obvious basic question that's waiting to be asked here, which is, what can I do to help with any of this? Even saying that, I start getting images of these stern, moralizing environmentalists, you know, castigating me for my poor habits with reusable grocery bags or for not owning a Nalgene water bottle or something. And I really shy away from that kind of preachy environmentalism. Preachy anything, really. But at the same time, it's reasonable to hear about these problems that are affecting us all and will continue to do so throughout our lives and wonder how to help. Or at least not hurt as much. For instance, I wanted to know from everyone I spoke to how they had changed their personal behaviors as a result of their professional pursuits, and whether they had any recommendations for how I might do the same. Can I recycle more, eat different fish, eat no fish, drive my car less often? And the answer about those kinds of things seemed to be more or less, yes, that's good. Do all those things that you know about that are good for the environment. It's not going to hurt, but it's not really going to change anything either.
But I think they're of great value in the sense that they are educational. If people walk around with their Monterey Bay food cards, it's doing good because it's making them aware of the issues. If people recycle, it's doing good because, I mean, recycling is actually an action which has achieved good things to scale. Fish food cards haven't yet, but they're getting there.
And it certainly doesn't hurt to feel better knowing when you're trying to be responsible about what you eat, where you put your trash, and what your carbon footprint might be like. And working on this episode, I've definitely found myself thinking about that stuff more. And if nothing else, I'm certainly suffering more guilt whenever I throw away a plastic cup, and I'm having a really hard time eating shrimp, which is a bummer because I really like shrimp. But like Lisa Ann said, these aren't moral questions. They're really pragmatic ones. The Earth doesn't care whether I feel better about my behavior. And so if changing it lands me somewhere between increasing my personal serenity and offering the most marginal improvements to the larger quality of life, I wanted to know whether there was anything else I could do.
Vote. Vote for the right people. There's a organization titled Ocean Champions, and they have one and only one goal, and that is to unelect people who are on the wrong side of these issues and to elect people who are on the right side of these issues. They have actually gotten about 6 or 7 people thrown out of the House of Representatives and replaced by people who care about these things by campaigning on exactly those issues. And so, see, I really believe that all of this stuff, you know, it's very much, it can go either way. So working on these political issues at a grassroots level, I firmly believe, is the only way you're going to see any change in the American political process.
But my immediate response to that is to think about this new Pew report I read the other day, whose headline was, "Current Congress is not the least productive in recent history, but close." And the previous Congress was in fact the least productive in recent history, in respect to the amount of substantive legislation it was able to pass. So getting a few more people who are in the House of Representatives who are, you know, on the side of the angels sounds good, but lately when I hear people tell me to trust in the political process, I have a hard time putting any stock in that. And that leaves aside the whole international angle, which is of course the actual more important one. Because even if the U.S. completely got its act together on the environment, that doesn't help dead zones in Brazil, carbon emissions in India, or plastic pollution in China. And once you start to put all those negative thoughts together, it's easy to get hopeless real quick. But Alan Seelan, who's dealt with these issues in real ways, put things in a different context for me on both the national and international fronts that at least took away some of my pessimism.
Just a little bit of history. When people ask the questions that you're asking, the response often is, well, that, you know, the political environment's not right now. It's for a variety of domestic, political, and economic reasons. The time's just not right. We just have to wait. Look back in history a while. In the early 1970s, in the middle of the Watergate scandal in Vietnam, the most divisive war in American history, the United States still found a way to enact far-reaching, important environmental legislation at home. We demonstrated very important United States leadership, 72 Stockholm Convention on the Human Environment. A lot of it was due to the personal leadership of Russell Train, who was President Nixon's chair of the Council on Environmental Quality. We came back with international agreement on what turned into the Ocean Dumping Treaty. You can move forward through both Democratic and Republican administrations. Under the Carter administration, agreement was reached at the initiative of the United States on really a far-reaching international agreement on tanker safety and pollution prevention, which resulted in significant reductions in the discharge of polluting oily ballast water from ships. That from the time President Carter initiated it, to the actual conclusion of the treaty, and it was a major, difficult, complicated treaty, was only 11 months. President Reagan showed great leadership in supporting the Montreal Protocol on protection of the stratospheric ozone layer. If you jump through history, there are many examples where the United States really has made a difference. One thing I was personally involved in under several administrations, but in particular, the first President Bush administration and the Carter administration was reaching agreement on a global ban on the sea disposal of nuclear waste and other toxic waste. These kinds of things make a difference. And the reason you have these agreements is you had the president, you had both Democratic and Republican members of Congress, you had economic leaders, you had people from business and industry, that you had environmental groups, and many others got together and agreed that, yes, this is in the national interest, and it's in the interest of the health of the global environment to agree to do these things. So it's not something that's beyond our reach.
All right. And on that note, thanks for listening to the show. As for the quarterly, I'm sorry to report that the sea issue is probably off the newsstands, but it will be available soon on our website as a back issue, so there's always a chance to pick it up if you haven't already. Meanwhile, our new issue, Death, is on the stands now, so go out and pick that one up. It's got all kinds of great readings from Edgar Allan Poe, Leo Tolstoy, Heraclitus, Philip Roth, Albert Camus, Robert Browning, Aeschylus, Plutarch, James Agee, Mary Roach. A real cast of winners. We've also got new essays from John Crowley, Virginia Morell, Brent Cunningham, and Bess Lovejoy. And don't forget that you can subscribe to the magazine, pick up other back issues that you've missed, read our Deja Vu and Roundtable blogs, and even donate money to us, all on our website, labwomsquarterly.org. You can also find links to follow us on every social mediosity you can imagine. Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook. Well, if you can imagine those three, then it's everyone. You can also follow me on Twitter, @FlaxClark. And as always, if you enjoyed the show, leave us some feedback in the comments section of the iTunes store. We'd really appreciate it. All right, until next time. And next time I've got some readings from a pretty awesome guest. Thanks for listening.